You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 11th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, live to tape, ladies and gentlemen. In other words, I'm on vacation this week, but through the wonders of technology, you will still get a full program with amazing new content. Content you've never heard before. Content you may never hear again, although if you download our podcast, you could hear it over and over again. Today on the program, author, filmmaker, blogger Jessica Valenti on the purity myth. Just one more way elements of our society wage war on women. Also on the program today, my interview with Congressman Keith Ellison, which we recorded on the day the Affordable Care Act arguments were being heard in front of the Supreme Court. And for you members, you get bonus time. Insurance whistleblower Wendell Potter, who will tell us that the mandate had been sought for quite some time by insurance companies, because they knew and they know that the private insurance market is a dysfunctional market and cannot survive without essentially what amounts to a government bailout. So today, Jessica Valenti, Keith Ellison, and for members, all that plus Wendell Potter. Make sure you stick around for tomorrow's show and Friday's show. All new material, folks. Brought to you by the wonder of technology and the wonder of the Majority Report. Enjoy. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Jessica Valenti. She is the author of The Purity Myth and the co-writer and subject of the documentary by the same name. She is one of the founders of Feministing. You can find her at jessicavalenti.com. And, of course, we'll have more links up to the film at majority.fm. Welcome to the program, Jessica.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Jessica, what is The Purity Myth?
Sure. So the purity myth is the lie that women's sexuality has some bearing on who they are and how good they are. And what I really wanted to do with the book and with the film was kind of explore that notion through a cultural lens, but also take away a look at the way that politics reinforces that idea through legislation and how that's kind of rolling women's rights back across the board.
You know, it's I have a six and a half year old daughter, and so I've become far more sensitive to this stuff. I mean, I like to think I was fairly sensitive to it. To it before as well, but it really is sort of stunning to sit down and read fairy tales to your daughter and to sort of start to see these things through this lens. And it's really it's rather disturbing.
It's very disturbing.
and one of the things early in the film, at least, you compare and contrast the character of young men versus the character of young women. Give me a sense of what that difference is that we see at such an early age across all forms of culture.
Sure. I mean, when you talk about young men's morality and the way that we kind of raise boys are taught that kind of universally accepted ethical ideals is what they should be fighting for and what they should be holding themselves up to. But for young women, you know, sure, they get a little bit of that, but we also get a lot of good girl, bad girl messages about sexuality from a very, very young age. And what I kind of explore in the book and the movie is the way that morality is often completely based on what women do or don't do sexually. You know, it's this super old school notion that if you do have sex, you're bad. And if you don't have sex, you're good and okay. And worthy of moral praise.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fairly easy thing that people can just ask themselves. I mean, what do they think of when they think of someone who's a, think of a 15-year-old boy, think of a 15-year-old girl and say, well, what does it mean if she is a good girl? And what does it mean if he is a good boy? They don't line up in terms of the same sort of characteristics. Now, what is that? I mean, is this a function simply of, obviously, this is not a new phenomenon. What is this a function of?
I mean, as you said, it's certainly nothing new. I mean, in terms of the morality and ethics question, I think it's a way to kind of keep women passive in a way, right? Because what could be more ethically passive than saying to young women, listen, in order to be a good person, just don't do this thing. Just don't have sex, right? You don't have to do anything active. You don't have to volunteer. You don't have to be a good person. You don't have to be kind or compassionate. Just don't have sex. And that means that you're a good person. So all of this stuff is very much related to this larger idea that women should be passive and submissive. You know, just super antiquated notions about gender.
I mean, in a way, it was sort of there was a vacuum left by the fact that for at least, you know, for a large part of our society, that women were not full citizens, essentially, were chattel in you know, for up until 20, 30 years ago, some of the laws in the books in different states, women were chattel. And so that it was just there wasn't any sort of like a notion or sense that women were obligated to sort of be as civically minded. You know, I'm thinking Boy Scout on one hand, I think you showed an example of that those values were just not important because you're not a full citizen.
Right. That's exactly right. And I would even argue that there's still a lot of laws on the books, you know, that treat women as chattel. I think it was up until 2006 or 2007, literally in, Maryland, if you started to have sex with someone and then you changed your mind and they kept going, that wasn't considered rape. Up until 2006, because of this super old school law that said once you're penetrated, the damage is done, you're not a virgin, so therefore nothing that happens afterwards is rape. And that the damaged party wasn't actually the woman at all, but her husband or her father. So this stuff still is around, unfortunately.
And we'll get into that because we can see that reflected later in the film as you walk us through this. Mm-hmm. And I should also add, let's talk a little bit about abstinence only, because I remember when the I first heard the stories of these purity balls, and abstinence only was obviously a huge issue during the Bush administration. I imagine it's still tell us about the abstinent only sort of movement that really seemed to get a lot of traction in over the past 10, 12 years.
Yeah, they've gotten a ton of traction, a ton of funding. It's really been unbelievable. Obviously, as you said, under the Bush administration, they were at their strongest and they were in almost every classroom, to the point where states started to refuse federal funding for sex education, because they would have to only teach abstinence and the programs were so ineffective and so terrible. And it wasn't just that they were giving out false medical and health information, which they were, which was incredibly dangerous. Saying things like condoms cause cancer. But the curricula was also extremely, extremely sexist and pushed very kind of traditional gender norms like, girls don't like sex, guys want sex all the time, it's up to girls to protect themselves from men. So it's really damaging stuff. And as much as we'd like to think that, now that we're under the Obama administration, that stuff isn't happening anymore, it's still getting a ton of funding. And if you look kind of on a local and state and community level, the curricula that was so popular under the Bush administration is still being taught in a lot of schools, and not just like the South and not just red states and places like California. It's really all over the place. So it's up to kind of parents on a community level to check out what's being taught at their kid's school and make sure that it's not this really damaging false information.
During the height of the funding during the Bush administration, it was $50 million a year. What are the figures today?
It's still, if I remember correctly, it's still $50 million a year through 2014. But the kind of qualifications to get federal funding are different. You do have to have accurate information. But there was this loophole that was left open that said, if you're a new program, and you can show that you're somewhat effective, that's okay. So a lot of the kind of abstinence folks who have been around for a long time are just creating new programs and trying to get funding that way. And they're using kind of, new and more progressive rhetoric, even though the message is very much the same. So they're still getting funded.
And, we have to talk about these purity balls because, they've always creeped me out. But again, when I first heard of them, I don't think I had a child at that point. Now I have a 7 or 6.5 year old. And, of course we are prepping for our first purity ball.
Of course. I hope so.
Tell people about this because it's disturbing.
It's very disturbing. So purity balls, which were federally funded, I should say, under the Bush administration, are essentially father-daughter dances. We're in the middle of the kind of revelry and dancing and food. The daughters will pledge their virginity to their fathers, and their fathers will pledge to protect their daughter's virginity. The language that they use seems very incestuous and sexualized to me. It's important to remember there are girls as young as 6 or 7 years old at these balls. They kind of dress up in prom gear, so they look very adult. And I would really recommend for people who haven't seen images of a purity ball to just look one up on YouTube, to really get kind of the full picture of what they're like. In one of the videos, the fathers give their daughters a charm necklace that's a lock and a key, and the daughter keeps the lock and the father keeps the key until the day she gets married and he gives the key/penis to her husband. the sexual symbolism is completely lost on them. And of course, there's no such thing as a purity ball for young men.
Right. Of course not. I mean, that's the thing is that, I like to dance with my daughter and she likes to dress up and, we, We dance quite a bit. She likes to dance. It's really the vow thing and this, the key and the, like, I'm going to put your vagina in my pocket and I'm going to give it to your husband someday. Because we don't have a goat to give him or whatever it is. It's disturbing, but it really, I think, begins to sort of lay bare what is behind this, that there is the sexuality for women is not only and your book and your documentary get to this, is that there is a use of, by reducing women to their sexuality, they are then much more easily controlled and subjugated. I mean, that's at the end of the day, that's what's really going on here.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And the kind of the interesting thing about purity balls, there was quite a backlash against their message because it's so obvious, as you said, and because it's so antiquated. I met the founder of purity balls, this guy named Randy Wilson, who is based out of Colorado Springs. And these days he's saying, you know, this is not about virginity at all. This is about a father-daughter relationship. And it's like, you know, if this is about a father-daughter relationship, you can be a Girl Scout leader. You can take your daughter to a dance without framing it as a date, without talking about her virginity. You know, dads should not be thinking about their grammar school age daughter's vaginas or virginity or hymens or whatever it is. That should just not enter in to their minds. But again, it is this very kind of patriarchal notion that dads own their daughter's virginity, and that this is a good way to kind of instill those passive values in girls at a very young age.
And the irony is that on some level it also continues to to sexualize them in some way. In other words, go ahead. I mean, talk about how that happened, because it's sort of a paradox.
It is, because, you know, what's interesting is that the abstinence only folks and the purity of all folks will say, you know, we're doing this as a response to the hypersexualized pop culture where girls are sexualized in the media. And that's certainly true, right? Like, young girls are very, very sexualized in the media. It's a huge problem. I don't think that you could come across anyone who thinks that it's not. But their response is just more sexualization, right? Like, when you focus on girls' virginity, when you tell girls that what's most important is not having sex, you're still focusing on their sexuality. So I just see them as two sides of the same coin. I don't see them as kind of different messages to give young women. You're still telling young women that the most important thing about them is whether or not they have sex.
Right. And so they basically have this binary choice in the way that they're going to identify themselves without any of the other aspects of being basically a person or a citizen in society. It just is, I'm either going to be a good girl or a bad girl. And that doesn't mean I'm going to help old ladies across the street. That doesn't mean that I'm going to be involved in charity. That doesn't mean any of those things. It's just one decision or the other as to, I'm going to be a slut or not a slut. And that's basically my choice as a girl in this life. And and then you go on to talk about essentially the implications of this as people get older. I don't even want to get to the vaginal
rejuvenation.
But it let's talk about how it also all of this is rolled into sort of anti-feminism. I also think that there's so many other tangential issues that sort of get rolled into women's rights. I think, you know, when you think about anti-science, of that, I think a lot of the sort of these same people sort of subscribe to that notion of science being bad. One of the things that science has been able to do has been emancipate women in some respect from them being simply vessels to carry children. And I'm talking about birth control, and we're seeing this just sort of unrelenting now, an expanding attack on reproductive rights. How does that all tie in?
I have to say, I'm actually happy to see them do this, because at least now it's out there and it's, you know, they're showing their true colors. Because for a really long time, none of these folks would admit that they were anti-contraception and anti-birth control, because birth control is too popular, right? 99% of American women use it. But these days they just can't hide it with social media and blogs and everything like that. It's out there. You know, the basic idea is that if you use contraception, if you use birth control, you're denying your kind of natural purpose as a woman. You're denying your femininity, you're denying your fertility, and that's just wrong, and that's impure as well. And it's just been so fascinating to see this play out, because they can't control their misogyny, right? Like when you saw Rush Limbaugh come out with this, like, oh my God, you're such a slut for even considering using birth control or talking about birth control. You're a prostitute if you want your birth control covered by insurance. It's like they don't even have the self-control to make kind of a political or scientific argument for their case. The misogyny is just so raw and out there. It just comes out in this incredible way.
I don't know. I mean, it just strikes me as there's almost sort of like there's two different tacks. There's the one that if you use birth control, you're obviously a slut because mm-hmm. you're having sex for pleasure,
correct?
As opposed to for what it's solely meant to at least to be, at least for women,
mm-hmm.
You know, which is to bear babies,
right?
But it also the unspoken part here too is that if a woman has the ability to control when or if she's going to be pregnant and continue to, or not, it gives her a lot of economic power.
That's right. It gives her a lot of economic power, power in the public sphere. But it's also, I think, it's this fear that if women are able to control their reproduction, we're just going to go crazy sexually, right? Which is really interesting, because their whole kind of basis for their ideology is this idea that women are naturally pure and naturally more chaste, that we don't want to have sex for pleasure, that it's not something that women like to do, that's something men like to do. But then on the other hand, if we're given things like birth control, then we're just going to, you know, be out of control, crazy sluts. So it's like they can't really make up their mind there. And of course, if women are naturally chaste or monogamous or, you know, not that interested in sex, why would you need all of these laws and social structures and mores to keep their sexuality in control? It just doesn't add up.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at here. Which came first? Is it at its heart, do you think it's a fear that women are going to all turn into just sort of these sex machines? or is it that at its heart, it really is about having to share part of the economic and power, you know, pie, if you will. I mean, you know, the thing is that these two things, and I think not by coincidence, sort of happened nearly simultaneously. The emancipation of women, sort of socially speaking, and their capacity to control, to have their own control over their ability to decide not to get pregnant happened very, very, almost simultaneously. And so I wonder if it is it this anxiety of the white male essentially losing, and they are, I mean, we shouldn't deny this. I mean, the fact is that when you start to, when you have a whole new half of the population, all of a sudden sort of getting more rights, more social emancipation, more economic emancipation, it's going mm-hmm. to take away from others.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's the same people who, you know, sort of, it's the daddy who felt that they own their wife and their daughters. And so what do you think, does one precede the other? Are they just sort of working in tandem? Is one driving the other without sort of like without really a total awareness about that?
You know, I think they're so interconnected. I don't know that I can say that one came before the other. I do think that there's this tremendous fear of female sexuality, and you know, and the fear with the fear comes this obsession, right? Like, there's a reason they're talking about like young virgins all the time, is because they're obsessed with young virgins. But I do think it's also this kind of desperate attempt to hold on to power and nostalgia for a time when women knew their place, right? You know, like the good old days when women were too busy popping out babies to be out in the public sphere making money and somehow emasculating their husbands
and, but
by
also,
not staying at home.
But also specifically taking money out of their pocket. I mean, yeah. You know, you have more competition. It's a real, I think it's a real phenomenon on some level.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree.
Where are we headed on this? I mean, you know, we're seeing this is all sort of like laid, bare, so to speak. You know, and I think in many respects, Rick Santorum can be a best friend, you know, is almost like a teaching aid in some respects. But, is this increased awareness? Has it turned a corner? Are women more conscious of this? I can look at the polling and say maybe they are in the context of mm-hmm. at least the political race. But have we turned the corner on this? Are we still in that place where, you know, things like abortion has to be icky and we have to sort of come to grips with, you know, it's really offensive to some people and we should meet them halfway in some way? Or are we at the place now where I think women are starting to realize, like, this is really about something more than someone feeling icky about a medical procedure?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that we are turning a corner. You know, I think that women and feminists especially have always felt this way and have always been kind of talking about this stuff. But with online activism being so powerful, with the power of social media, this stuff has just blown up. And you're really seeing, you know, not just the way that women feel about these issues, but you're seeing kind of this hyper awareness and really incredible outreach that you wouldn't have seen 10 years ago when the internet was a very different place. You know, you can't say something like women should just put an aspirin between their knees and have that go unnoticed. You know, it doesn't go unnoticed. Look what happened with Komen and Planned Parenthood. The internet exploded. People went crazy. So I really think we're at this moment where conservatives still have their same old agenda for women and traditional gender norms, but they're being met with this incredible kind of online activism and feminist presence and women's presence online, and they don't know what to do with it. So I'm very hopeful. I'm very optimistic that it is turning a corner, that American women are not going to stand for it. But of course that remains to be seen. You know, it was a hot topic for a while with Komen and Rush Limbaugh. And it remains to be seen if we can kind of harness that energy and use it for more proactive and less defensive change.
Jessica Valenti from jessicavalenti.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll put links to the purity myth at majority.fm.
Thank you.
Every day I get up and pray to John. And he increases the number of clocks by exactly one. Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. Last night there were skinheads on my lawn. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Some people say that bowling alley's got big legs. Bowling alleys all look the same.
Look the same. Look the same.
There's not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything.
Anything. Anything.
Had a dream last night, but I forget what it was.
What it was. What it was.
Take the skin.
With me now, we are steps away from the Supreme Court building. During the hearing on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, with me now, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Keith Ellison. He is the Congressman Keith Ellison. He is, of course, the representative of the 5th Congressional District of Minnesota. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Sam. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Now, I want to ask you, okay, we will know by June, I guess,
yeah,
end of June, what the ruling of the Supreme Court was. This week, what I've seen from analysts on the oral arguments as to the constitutionality of the mandate, analysts have suggested that the defendants in this case, the Obama administration, and all of the hundreds of amicus briefs that have been filed, at least the Supreme Court justices were sort of projecting a sense that they felt the mandate may not be constitutional. Without trying to speculate what's in their minds, has the Democrats in Congress talked about politically and policy-wise what they will do, how they will message, where they'll go if the Affordable Care Act is struck down?
Well, you know, there's a number of directions to go in, and I got to be honest with you, Sam, I haven't really thought them through. I'm working on winning, not figured on the alternative. But one thing is you got a Republican-stacked Supreme Court, a bunch of market fundamentalists, the Citizens United Supreme Court, who, you know, basically disrupted people's opportunity to get health care. And so that'll be one thing. The other thing, though, is a response where I think while it is important for the individual mandate to exist in order to deal with pre-existing conditions, spread the pool wide enough so we can, you know, make everybody kind of carry the weight, it's not essential. And you could set up a system of incentives to try to achieve the same outcome. Would you get the same number ultimately? I don't know, but I don't think it's fatal. I would think that, you know, there are parts of the bill that, you know, are severable enough such that there could be a response. Of course, within the context of the United States House of Representatives today, I mean, they wouldn't do anything to help the American people. They haven't. And so we'd have to use it to make sure that we got the next picks on the Supreme Court, which would mean we'd have to make sure that Obama won. I mean, if they were to strike this bill, I could think of no better reason to argue that President Obama needed to be the president for at least 4 more years so that we can get a Supreme Court that truly is going to apply the law in a respectful way. But let me just take a step from there and make even another comment, if you don't mind, Sam.
Please.
Hey, look, man, if we had a single payer, we wouldn't be talking about individual mandate. So, you know, look, I'm on the team. I'm for upholding the bill and all that. And I really am. But I just do want to point out that going to the doctor ought to be like getting fire services, police services, emergency medical services, public school services. It ought to be like that. It ought to be something that's in our taxes, and you go if you need it.
In fact, in some ways, health insurance does have a special status already in our society, and that is implicit in the argument as to why the mandate is constitutional, because there is no other legislation where, I mean, we could talk about, we can't force everybody to buy computers,
right.
But there is no legislation also that says that if you go to the computer store, the computer store has to give you a computer if you don't have the money to afford it. But it is the case with health insurance. I mean, so it
Very
is
true.
Already noticed as a special status in our society.
No question about it. I mean, you know, there's a reason why, you know, if you got your health, and we all know this, you know, you pretty much got everything you need at that point. Health is one of those things where it is inhumane to deny it to anyone. When we think of, you know, torture or inhumane treatment, it's the denial of health care or the refusal to administer services. If you find yourself, no matter what kind of a person you are who wants to simply duck out of society, if you turn up in need of health care, they gotta take care of you. This is a humane thing to do. If that's humane, then it means that we all ought to have some responsibility as well. So that's why I think, well, one of the reasons why I think that the mandate should stay in place.
You mentioned that you're a supporter of single payer health care, as am I, and you are by my estimation one of the most outspoken people in Congress in terms of like getting a national platform as a congressman who is also espousing a member of the Progressive Caucus who is you are one of those important and. Frankly, not enough voices out there supporting. How can progressives who have been frustrated by by the Obama administration, by frankly some of your colleagues in Congress, for being corporatist on issues of civil liberties. How can progressives get more leverage?
Well, the progressive caucus has only the progressive community to rely on. I mean, when the Blue Dogs want to extract concessions out of Nancy Pelosi back when we were in the majority, they would threaten to vote with the Republicans and they could hold their votes. Whereas there's nobody to the left of the Progressive Caucus, so who do we use to get leverage? The people. I will say the reason I ran for Progressive Caucus co-chair, and me and Raul Grijalva are the co-chairs of the caucus, 77-member caucus, is because I wanted to address the very issue you mentioned. And we're trying to do basically three things. One, build greater cohesion among members so that we can hold our votes. Two, that we have a better and stronger, more enduring relationship with the progressive base. And we've been working on that quite a bit. And then three, that we got to play politically. In the past, Progressive Caucus has not played politically. What do I mean? We're not donating any money. We're not campaigning to get progressives. We're not trying to populate the caucus with progressives. We're just hoping for the best. We're changing that. We are going in a new direction. We're getting more active. Here's the thing. The progressive community cannot introduce and pass legislation. The progressive caucus cannot move the American people and organize them in a progressive way and mobilize them. So the progressive community and the progressive caucus need each other. And so that's what I'm working on. I view this as a multi-year project, but I am absolutely committed to it. So is Raul Grijalva. And so, you know, let's say I need to come back on the show so we can talk about this stuff.
Congressman Keith Ellison, always welcome. I appreciate you taking the time today. Thank you.
Say it, you're not prepared.